My name's Jesse. I'm an alcoholic. And it's been a real privilege for me to get to be able to host our speaker this weekend. We've hung out some, went and ate, and he's an alcoholic. I think we'll get a really good talk, and I introduce Gavin.
Hi, buddy. My name's Gavin. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, you got that right. I am an alcoholic. So is he. Like to say hi to the smokers in the back room. Feel sorry for you. They got you walled off back there. And I used to smoke, so I know how hard that is to quit and how long most of us wanted to do that before it happened. Either God exists or he doesn't. Doesn't that sound like the beginning of a hellfire and brimstone sermon? It's a quotation from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suppose the next sentence implied is if there is a God, it'd be a good idea to have a relationship with him. And I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Having a quality relationship with a higher power. And there may be some new people here who are frightened with that word God. But I want to assure you, it's God as you understand him. So I hope you don't try to stay sober by yourself, and I hope you find the freedom to find some kind of prayer that you can be comfortable with. Doesn't have to be like anybody else's prayer. As long as you try to stay sober with the help of some kind of higher power. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a grateful member of Al-Anon and a recovering bigot. I can say I'm already in trouble here. I like that moment of silence at the beginning. In Sunday morning, people pray a little more than usual. So I'd like to include another prayer here. You can identify with this. Dear God, I thank you because today I've not been resentful, angry, jealous, self-centered, arrogant, or afraid. But I think I'll still need your help because pretty soon I'll have to get out of bed. Someone wrote a book, I think it's out of print now, on alcoholism, had a wonderful title, Thirst for Freedom. And I always felt caged in and wasn't locked up like Sonny, thank God. But I felt locked up a lot of the time. In looking back on what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized that the very first thing we give people when they walk through that door, freedom. Come on in. We're not going to label you. We're not going to pry into your business, but hang around with us for a while. And we're going to give you the freedom to figure out if you think you belong here or not. But you're welcome while you're checking that out. And we're going to give you the freedom to find out about a higher power or get back in touch with one that you've already known. And we're not going to push you on that. I was trying to count, I'm not a mathematician either, I was trying to count the other night, I think I've been to 5,000 plus AA meetings since I've been sober. And you know, in not one of those meetings have I ever heard anybody tell anybody else how to believe in God. That's amazing. For a group of people who are interested in growing spiritually, not telling you how you have to do that personal, very precious, special relationship. And as was pointed out by some of our previous speakers, God works through people. And he sure works through funny-looking people. Have you ever noticed? Jeez. A friend of mine in the program, George, and I used to get together for coffee or lunch about every 2 weeks. And one week he'd choose the restaurant, and the next week I'd choose the restaurant. And every time it was my turn to choose the restaurant, I chose Bill Johnson's Big Apple on East Van Buren in Phoenix. And George didn't like that restaurant. part of the reason I chose it. And one day he slides into that booth, and he's got pain all over his face. And I said, George, you really don't like this restaurant, do you? And I loved it because it's got sawdust on the floor, and the waitresses wear six guns and say y'all. It's got great food. He said, I can't stand this place. I said, what's wrong with it? He said, it's full of ugly people. And I thought, what an awful thing to say. But then I looked around, and he was right. So George and I had this little in-joke between the two of us. You know, I'd be traveling around the country, and every now and then I'd call him and say, where are you? I said, I'm in Seattle or Portland or wherever. He said, what are you doing up there? I said, they're having an ugly convention. You wouldn't believe how many ugly people there are here. And you know, that's kind of a silly little joke, but some people found out about what George and I were doing. You know, there's some people that are so ugly, they live underground all year. They come out once a year and go to the state fair. If you want to look for uglies, go to the state fair. And in some way, we're all ugly. None of us fit that TV image of Ozzie and Harriet or the movie star or starlet or anything. We all have character defects. And you know, those of us who come to this program find out about that. And we find out we can talk about our ugliness here. People don't talk about their ugliness many other places. And that ugliness is one of the reasons why a lot of us drank so long. And why we tried to look for beauty in all the wrong places. I grew up out west. I was country before country was cool. So I slip into song titles without knowing it. My favorite, it doesn't get much play right now, but it's, have you heard it? That's My Girl, But It Ain't My Truck. Guy drives by his girlfriend's house, and there's some other fellow visitor, you know? That's My Girl, But It Ain't My Truck. You know, marketing people that are involved in sales, have discovered that alcoholics are the number one purchasers of country western music. Isn't that amazing? It's not surprising when you realize most of it's based on self-pity. You all know that perfect country western song, you know, it rained the day my mom got out of prison, you know, it goes on. Those same people discovered that most alcoholics, in addition to buying most of that music, think they can sing real well. And in actual fact, we can't. I wish Nancy was here this morning. Boy, I enjoyed every one of the speakers, the ones that are here and the ones that are on the way home. One of the speakers said that something like a sobriety stew. Everybody had a little bit different angle on the things that I care the most about. And boy, it was a tasty meal. Anyway, Nancy could tell you about singing. To be able to sing well, you have to do that scale real well. You know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Every time an alcoholic tries that, it comes out like this. Me, 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 me. And we don't think other people know what our problem is. You know, we're going around, me, 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 me. I'm real comfortable here this weekend. I'm just getting over a cold. I feel good this morning for the first time in about 10 days. But you people have been wonderful to be with, even Friday when I arrived and couldn't talk. So I may get a little silly. Somebody sent me a list of the worst country western song titles. I don't know if this is a real one or not, but it goes right to the heart of the treasured tragedies that many of us have. You know, those are the things you dust off when company comes. Did you hear what she did to me? Yeah. Anyway, here's the song title. Get your tongue out of my mouth, I'm kissing you goodbye. I am a real alcoholic. I have no doubt about that. And we are supposed to qualify, so let me make sure I do that. thought I would know where this little place is. I spent a lot of my life in Phoenix, Scottsdale area, and my folks lived in Tucson. I had terrific parents and used to like to visit them a lot. And I get down there every 2 or 3 weeks. It's like 120 miles away. And I couldn't get from Phoenix to Tucson without stopping somewhere to have a drink. And I used to have this was before I-10 was open all the way. I used to have a favorite little bar in a place called Maricopa. And one night I was in there and just got my drink, and a woman came in and caught her husband with his girlfriend. Got it? She never had evidence before. She suspected this. It was the first time she caught them together. And she flipped out. And there was a pool table in there. And she starts picking up the balls off the pool table and chucking them at this couple. And this lady had an arm. I mean, it was like an old Western movie. You know, she's chipping plaster and breaking bottles. And I guess there are about 20 of us in there. And, man, we're all out in the street in about 10 seconds, huh? Didn't want to get hit with a pool ball. And I remembered I left my drink on the bar. So I went back there dodging all this stuff, rescued by Drake and joined my friends out on the street. Social drinkers don't do that. That drink is not that important to social drinkers. Something that in the Phoenix area is very popular with teenagers is, you know, it's hot there and it's dry, but there's a couple of rivers not too far away. And one of the things I used to love to do is get a bunch of inner tubes and blow them up and get someone to haul them up to the Verde River and sit in those inner tubes and float down the river. And when I first came to Phoenix, I had something to do with a youth group, and I borrowed a school bus, and I took about 30 of these kids out to the Verde River, and I dumped them in the river with a couple of chaperones, and I drove the bus downstream to where they were going to float by about 3 hours later. And I'm there in this bus by myself. This is how our alcoholic minds work. And I'm there by myself, and it's hot. And I suddenly realize I'm hungry. And I know what I'm hungry for. Popcorn. By the way, Icky Paw kids, thanks for the popcorn. That was great. And thanks for that hospitality room. That was terrific. You know, in the Old Testament, Sarah got pregnant when she was 80. God still works like that. I'm 60 years old. Last weekend, I spoke at a young people's conference in Scottsdale. What am I doing at a young people's conference? They said, well, you still got growing to do, don't you? Okay. Anyway, I distracted myself. I'm in that school bus and I'm hungry. And that's what my mind tells me. And I drive by probably half a dozen convenience stores and half a dozen supermarkets till I got to Lulabelle's in Scottsdale, which was a bar where there was a big bowl of free popcorn. I wasn't hungry, I was thirsty. But my mind told me I was hungry. And I never got back to the river. I woke up the next day in my own bed at home, and I thought about those kids. And I jump up and I look out the window, and that borrowed school bus is there. No kids. You know, it is a family disease. All of those teenagers covered up for me. Somehow they knew there was something wrong with me, but they really loved me and cared about me. And I don't know how they all got home. And I don't know what kind of stories they told to keep the heat off of me, but they did. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful in the family as much as in the individual. I want to thank Charlie for a phrase that describes my experience with alcohol. I've never heard it put better. Absolutely, incredibly wonderful. Boy, that talks about that zing, huh? That's what it was like. So I think you know I'm an alcoholic. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think it was going to work. I didn't know I was an alcoholic till the very end. I like circuses. I've always been going to circuses since I've been 6 years old. Hugo, Oklahoma, isn't in this state, isn't it? Golly. We could have gone to Hugo. That's the winter quarters for Carson and Barnes and Kelly Miller Circuses. And I've never been to Hugo. I've got to have to come back. Anyway, toward the end of my drinking, I don't know I'm an alcoholic, but I know I'm crazy. And I know I'm crazy because I keep doing things I don't want to do. I keep doing things I disapprove of. I keep doing things you disapprove of. And I can't stop. And when I took that first drink of alcohol, which was in my 20s, by the way, and felt that absolutely incredible, wonderful feeling, I could be anybody I wanted to be. And I was a little kid with an inferiority complex up until that part. And a couple other speakers have described that transformation better than I can. Oh, it happened. I could be anybody I wanted to be. Until one day I wasn't who I wanted to be anymore. And by then I couldn't quit drinking. That's my story. Alcohol used to work for me, and I wound up working for alcohol. Our drinking stories differ. Mine was I had to drink all day long. Very rarely got stupid drunk, but it was 3-4 years before anybody saw me sober. And they didn't, even when I went to treatment, they didn't think I was an alcoholic. They just said, well, he's nervous. Well, that was true, too. I used to have the shakes. Not all alcoholics have the shakes, but I had them bad. Sobered up in Michigan, and I went back there about 6 months after I was sober, and people said things to me then that I know we don't say to people in AA. They said, we never thought you'd stop shaking. We never thought you'd make it. We didn't think you could stay sober. And I have. And thanks to God and a lot of ugly-looking people, you know, that's 29 years now. And I love it. My biggest fear was Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work for me. My second biggest fear was I was going to get bored. I have not got bored. That's amazing. I love going to meetings. I go to a lot of them. Not because I think I'm going to drink today anymore, but because that's where my people are. And that's where that connection happens. And that's where today, without alcohol, I have that absolutely incredible, wonderful experience. Happens every time we get together. And if that hasn't happened to you yet, please keep coming back. Say some kind of a prayer that you can be comfortable with. Go to meetings and don't drink. And get a sponsor. I want to tell you three of my favorite stories. I'm going to be jumping around a little bit here. But I paid real good attention to the other speakers, and I don't want to repeat much of the kind of thing that they talked about, so mine will be kind of scattered. But it's amazing what happens to us around here. You know, I thanked Cliff last night for that wonderful talk that he gave us earlier in the conference. And I told him I lived about 8 miles from Oceanside, where he's from. And you know what he told me? He found out where I went to school and all that. He told me that one of my college professors got a year's sobriety before he died. And I can't tell you what that means to me. I didn't know this man drank, but I knew he was weird, and I knew he was crazy, and I knew that some people got grades that were different than what they should have been. He probably got us all mixed up. But he died sober and comfortable. And that was worth coming to Oklahoma City to find out that Val died sober and happy. Those are the kind of things that please me today. Golly, I don't feel old. I was in San Francisco recently. I found a neat thing in San Francisco. You can ride the bus for 35 cents anywhere you want to go, and it's quicker than cars, and you don't have to pay for the parking. That was the good news. The bad news was in the week I was there riding the bus, 4 different women on 4 different buses got up to give me their seat. They must have saw something I didn't see. I'm so old, I predate styrofoam cups. That came up here. We used to have to wash them. And I've been going to church all my life. Still go to church. And that's not why we're here this morning. That has something to do with the bigotry I was talking about. It wasn't racial bigotry. It's never been that. My dad was a contractor, and he had a lot of guys working for him from different races and different cultures and different tribes. And those were my buddies, because I worked for my dad. And those guys taught me the shortcuts. And they covered up my mistakes. They were my friends. But the kind of bigotry I'm talking about sounds like this. This is how I grew up. Baptists usually get blamed for this kind of an attitude, but take it easy on the Baptists. You know, they're right. Anyway, it sounded like this inside of my head. You know, I'm a Roman Catholic. Too bad about you guys. Isn't that awful? That's how I grew up. Thought I had an inside track. Spiritual arrogance. Anyway, I'll come back to that a little later. One day at our club at 4848 South Central, I was in the kitchen washing the cups and the ashtrays. And I'm putting my elbows in soap suds, and this gal comes up behind me, and man, she'd been looking for AA all her life. She really needed it. She's a very successful woman. But she'd never been to a church. She'd never been around anybody that talked about God, and she gets to AA, and they start talking about God. And she was so efficient and so quick, she wanted to catch up all at once. So she used to ask any of us that have been around longer than her all these embarrassing questions about spirituality. Like, do you really believe in God? Most of us pause before we answer that a little bit, because it's such a powerful question. And she would do it with so much love, you couldn't get angry at her. Anyway, I'm busy doing the dishes, and I'm not real good at that. So it takes all my concentration, and I'm, you know, worried about this crud on this ashtray. And she comes up behind me, and she says, "Gavin, if you had to describe God in one word, what would it be?" And I said, I didn't have time to think. I turned around and said, "Sneaky." Now, I don't mean that irreverently. If I had to describe God in one word today, I could use a lot of words, but one of them, it would be very accurate, would be sneaky. In a very playful mischief. You think AAs have humor. God has a lot of humor. I mean, look around. Toward the end of my drinking, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just knew I was crazy. And I was at Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus running around the backyard. I knew the performance director, and I had access to all those performers and doing interviews with some really fascinating people, you know, lion tamers and acrobats and midgets and jugglers. Can you imagine a drunk getting into a circus for nothing and being able to talk to all these exciting people? That's what was going on. And that was the last year that there was going to be one Ringling Brothers show. It's split up into two units now. You may not know that. Red unit and a blue unit. They alternate towns every year. But a lot of the old-timers were upset about that, and they were going to quit. And a couple of them had told me they were going to give me interviews, and I hadn't got around to them yet. So I go flying down to the railroad tracks, 15th Avenue and the Santa Fe tracks. It's all different down there now, but that's where they're loading up the train to go to Los Angeles. And I parked my car in this vacant lot. There was more to it than that. There were weeds in the vacant lot. And under the weeds was an irrigation ditch that I didn't seem to notice. So I drove my car into this hole in the ground. And right away, the front wheels drop into this hole, and the back wheels are up in the air, spinning around. And I get out of the car, and it's right by this 15th Avenue, and a lot of traffic there, and people start stopping to try to figure out how their car got in that funny position. And I'm a good enough mechanic to know I'm not going to get out of there by myself, and I'm too embarrassed to call any friends and too cheap to call a wrecker, and everybody with Ringling Brothers knows me at least by sight. So I go up to someone with a, because I'd seen, you know, down on another siding they had tractors and forklifts and all kinds of diesel equipment, and I thought I'd get one of those guys to pull me out, you know. So I went up to someone with a circus, and I said, "My car's in a ditch. We're going to have to get it out." Now, those are two big clues to alcoholism right there. I created the impression I had nothing to do with the car getting in the ditch, and I recruit an enabler right away, you know. We are going to have to get it out. And he said, "Nothing to it. I'll be right back." Well, he disappeared, the crowd gets bigger, and about 10 minutes later he came back. No forklift, no tractor, he had an elephant. You know, they put a work harness on Targa, that was her name, and she pulls my car out of this ditch in front of a really big crowd. Now, when the elephant showed up, the crowd got big. That was embarrassing. Something I usually don't mention in talks, or sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but not only do I still go to the Catholic Church, I'm a priest. And that incident got in the newspapers. In case you were wondering if the elephant really happened, it did. It, you know, we could look up the old newspaper article, you know, something about ponderous pachyderm rescues portly priest. I added the portly part. That really didn't make the newspaper. But my most vivid memory that night is some little kid yanking on its parents' clothing saying, "Look, look, look at the elephant pull the drunk's car out of the ditch." Could have killed that little kid. You know what I'm thinking? How dare parents have a young child like that out so late at night? You know, here's this disaster going on that I created, and I missed the point. I'm worried about parenting. And guess who needed the parenting? And I got a lot of it. We call them sponsors. I went home that night. I know this is a rather dramatic story, but it's all true. And I'm sitting in the kitchen drinking scotch out of a coffee cup. That's another clue. Social drinkers don't do that. And you know why I'm drinking. It's embarrassing. I want oblivion. I want escape. And it didn't happen. And I can't explain it physiologically. But the experience I had was, the more I drank, the soberer I got. I want escape and I get clarity. Man, I didn't want clarity. That clarity was awful. And I'm saying these words, I think I said them out loud. I used to talk out loud when I drank, whether anybody was there or not. Used to ask myself questions, too. I knew I was in trouble. One day I asked myself a question. I said, "Huh? Well, we're not in very good shape when we get here." You know, step two talks about being restored to sanity. I don't have any trouble with that, but you know, half the time I don't think I need to be restored to sanity or that I'm insane as much as I'm retarded. You know, I figure stuff out after it's all over. You know, kind of going through life like, "Oh, that's what that was about." But if I hang around with you people, you're so quick, you catch on quicker than I do. See, and I get to take a free ride on that. You catch on quicker than I do about what's important in life. See what I mean about God being sneaky? I'm talking to myself and I'm saying, "This is impossible. I couldn't park in a ditch. And the elephant didn't pull me out. Someone with the circus wouldn't turn down money, and that happened too." Here's the next thought I had. If these impossible things could happen, I could be an alcoholic. Nobody ever called me that. I never thought about that before. But this is amazing. That quick I knew that's what I was. And I had a favorable impression of Alcoholics Anonymous because of two friends that I had admired, and they both told me that they had a quality, wonderful life today, and they were so successful personally in their lives because of a thing called AA. So tucked away in the back of my mind was this thing, is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a good thing. It helps people be comfortable with themselves. It helps them be the kind of people I like to be around and love. And so I picked up the phone and I called Larry. He lived in Tucson at that time. And I was hysterical on the phone. He said it was a couple of minutes before he could figure out who it was because I'm crying. And finally he says, "Oh, Gavin, is that you?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "What's the matter?" And I blurted out, "I think I'm one of you." I couldn't say the word alcoholic yet, huh? That was the low point in my life. "I think I'm one of you." But it got lower real quick, because you know what Larry said? "Terrific!" Oh, God, I could have died. You know, I call myself this most awful thing I can think of, and he's getting off on it. Huh? He hooked me up with a man that later became my first sponsor, and took me a little while to get sober. But after that first meeting, I haven't had a drink. Thank God. See what I mean about God being sneaky? How many people do you know that were 12-stepped by an elephant in a small trial? That's how I got here. You know, those little strange pieces of our history that add up to get our attention and to get us here. The next story I want to tell you is my very favorite. It's not humorous, but it's my favorite story. Let me tell you about my first sponsor. I went to a meeting every night for the first couple of years. Les was an old man, hunched over, arthritic, TV salesman. And I go to a meeting with Les, and then we'd clean up the club, and then we'd go out for coffee with some people. And then each night he would say the same thing, and it was like it was new each night. He'd say, why don't you come down to the house, we'll shoot some pool for a while. And went down to the house and I'd shoot pool till midnight or 12:30 or 1. I told you how crazy I was when I got here and how people didn't think I would stay sober. Les knew how fragile I was. He knew how delicate my ego was. And he knew a meeting wasn't enough for me. He knew I needed to be with somebody. So he'd invite, I didn't figure this out 2 years later, he'd invite me down to the house to shoot pool. I lived in a different part of town. I didn't get to that house for quite a while. I went down to return a book to his wife, Ruth, one day. And the pool table was out of the family room. And I said, Ruth, the pool table isn't in the family room anymore. She says, yeah, we put it in storage. You know, Les never did like to shoot pool. Here's this 70-plus-year-old man staying up to the wee hours shooting pool with me because he knew I needed to be with somebody, and he didn't like to play pool. You can't pay back that kind of love. Les waited till I got really screwed up. It was about a year sober. And I knew I was screwed up because of an incident. I was in a residential neighborhood, and I'm doing about 50, 55 miles an hour in this residential neighborhood, and I nearly hit a little boy on a bicycle. I didn't hit him, but I came real close. I still have a very vivid picture of how close I came. And I got the car stopped, and the little boy got so frightened, he wobbled around on that bike and fell off the bike, and I get out of the car, and I go running back to help him. And if I read the body language right, he figured I missed him with the car, now I'm going to run him down on foot. You know, and he hops on that bicycle, and he is gone. I hope I tell this story enough so that someday I'll meet him and be able to apologize, make some amends. I was so shook at what almost had happened. I'm not drinking. I don't want to drink. But I'm a space cadet. My mind is never where the vehicle is when I'm driving it. I was so shook up, I couldn't start the car. So I walked a couple of blocks and found a phone booth, and I called my sponsor, and I said, Les, there's really something wrong with me, and you know all about me. Tell me what it is. He said, where are you? He said, I'm in a phone booth. Like, he ought to know. You know, sponsors carry a list of phone booths. He says, well, come on down to the house tonight. I'll tell you what's wrong with you. I've been waiting for you to ask. So I went down to the house that night, and he said, Gavin, you want to know what's wrong with you? I'll tell you what's wrong with you. Now let me back up a little bit. A couple of things. You know, I like circuses. I worked for the United States Air Force at Travis for a year, and they were flying all of the wounded from our side to Travis. So I saw 80-85% of the wounded in 1 year period of time. It was an incredible job. Let me tell you about Willie. God gets us ready for this stuff before we know we need it. See, I'm a Catholic priest, I'm fully employed by the Air Force, but I'm not a member of the Air Force, which means I have officers' privileges, get to go to the officers' club. I like that. The organist would play my song when I walked in. Everybody knew I was there. I hear that song anymore, I gag. Then I thought it was hot stuff. We had those troops there a day or two, and then if they were well enough, we've got them on another flight to take them near a veterans or military hospital near their family as part of getting well. And I'm in this ward with four guys, and there's a guy over here in the corner that I haven't got to yet, and I like him a lot. They didn't have any paperwork on anybody, and I dressed like a priest, you know, with the black and the little white thing. And so everybody knows what I'm about. But the job description was I had to be everybody's chaplain. So if you're a Presbyterian, my job is to help you be a better Presbyterian. If you're a Mormon, help you be a better Mormon. I did okay with the Catholics. Every now and then I'd get over my head with this other stuff, and I'd have to call for help. You know, there was always some other chaplain or minister or rabbi that would come by. It was a wonderful job. For those of you that are educators, you took a lot of those courses in schools about teaching. And there's a phrase that educators use called teachable moments. This was a teachable moment. These guys just got shot at. They are home in this country. They're safe. Nobody is shooting at them. They might be missing part of their body, but they're happy to be home. A lot of times I saw those guys get off the aircraft and kiss the asphalt because this country meant so much to them. They get up to the hospital, there are pretty nurses around, they approved of that. Red Cross says, here's a carton of cigarettes if you smoke, here's a telephone, talk to anybody you want for 10 minutes. And I get to walk in at this teachable moment. And because I didn't have paperwork on the troops, I'd tell them who I am and thank them for what they did for this country and for some other people and tell them I'm glad they're safe and alive and ask them what is their religion. And this one guy that I'm watching out of the corner of my eye, I like him before I get to him. His name's Willie. And he's a black Marine sergeant, really built. And he'd been machine gunned across the chest, and it broke his arm up. That was in a cast. They had to do a lot of work on that yet. But he'd never seen the wound on his chest before, and he's a very muscular guy, so there's a lot of bulk there. And the nurse is putting saline solution or some kind of solution on that dressing so that when she takes it off, it won't hurt. And he's giving her a bad time. He said, rip that sucker off. Go help somebody that needs you. I like the guy, huh? The nurse did just what she said, what he said. You know, she goes, rip, and that thing comes off. And all of us in that room kind of, you know, did this double take except Willie. He vaults up out of bed. Never seen that wound before. He looks in the mirror. He's looking at his ribs where all the flesh and muscles have been shot away. He says, that ain't so bad. Hops back at base. Put a Band-Aid on that. Go help somebody else. I like the guy. So when I get to him, I go through my regular routine. I get to my question. I say, what's your religion? You know what he said? The Marine Corps. Okay, now here's the beautiful thing. No sooner had he said that, he thought he had embarrassed me. Huh? He said, oh, sir, I'm out of line. I shouldn't have done that. That was improper. I apologize. He said, I've just never been in church. He said, but I believe in God. He's my buddy. My buddy goes everywhere with me. I talk to my buddy all day long. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my buddy. I hope you have a buddy for God. Or God for buddy. And we talked about his buddy for about an hour. I'm in the midst of my active alcoholism. The Air Force has given me great performance reviews. I am trying to make sure they don't find out they have a lunatic with a high security clearance working for them. And guess who ministered to who that day? You know who did. The next day, the aircraft he was supposed to be on had engine trouble. I got to spend another hour with Willie. Third day, he got outranked by everybody. Spent another day with Willie. And we corresponded for 6 or 8 years, lost track of each other. But what a wonderful relationship. Willie knew all about conscious contact. His buddy was more real to me than the God that I grew up with was to me. What a wonderful way God had of preparing me for Alcoholics Anonymous with my arrogance and my bigotry. to find a lot of troops who weren't Roman Catholics, who were deeply spiritual, and some of them didn't even go to church, who had what I wanted, like Willie. I'm not exaggerating to impress you. I think if I had to list the five most spiritual people I ever met in my life, Willie'd be on the list. I don't have any doubt about that. What a wonderful gift God gave me. So then I get to an anonymous program where it's God as you understand him, and I find out that all kinds of people experience God differently. And what a personal, precious thing that is. I'll tell you a little bit about Jay. Jay grew up in a denominational religion that doesn't like Catholics. It's not supposed to talk to Catholics. And every time I'd sit next to him at a meeting, he'd move. Jay and I knew each other for about 3 months, and after this meeting, he said, I want to talk to you, and he's shaking. And I said, sure. He said, come on out back. I thought, oh, geez. Well, it's going to be one of those deals. We get outside, and he said, my church tells me I'm not supposed to be talking to people like you, but I got to talk to you. Right away, I get into the mode where I'm going to help them, right? And here he says, you are so screwed up, I'm going to pray for you. Is there anything you can do to keep me from praying for you? You really need a lot of help. Man, I'll take those prayers every day. Isn't that a beautiful story? During that stint with the Air Force, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I didn't know I was one. But I knew I was spiritually sick. And I figured out, you know, I psychoanalyzed myself. Don't do that. It's like do-it-yourself brain surgery. It starts out okay, but you lose track of stuff down the line. See? And I came up with the diagnosis that I suffered from excessive guilt. I heard a guy about 8 years into sobriety list some of the characteristics of alcoholics and addicts, and he said all addicts suffer from excessive guilt. Man, I ran up, gave him a big hug, and I said, don't ever leave that out of your talk. There's something I try not to leave out of my talk, too. When I first got here, I was very suicidal. And for the first year, year and a half of sobriety, I was very suicidal. And I finally worked up enough courage one night to talk about it at a meeting. And nobody touched it until the meeting was just about over. And one guy said, oh, you're the fellow with the suicidal feelings. And I said, yeah. He said, I can help you with that. You know what those are? I said, no. He said, those are suicidal feelings. Well, thanks a lot. He said, you know, you've been around long enough to know that when you feel like drinking, you don't have to drink. I said, yeah. He said, has it ever occurred to you that if you feel like killing yourself, you don't have to do that? That had never occurred to me. It was like a weight lifted off my shoulders. Now, I'm not the only person in this room who's probably been suicidal, so I'd like to share that wisdom. Isn't it amazing where the wisdom comes from? I do have a little experience with young people. Tucson didn't have a young people's group for a long time, and I used to go to the one in Phoenix, you know, 25 years ago. And so one night we met in Casa Grande, 3 or 4 carloads of alcoholics from Phoenix and 3 or 4 from Tucson. We borrowed a Lutheran church in Casa Grande, and we had us a meeting. It was wonderful. It became a monthly meeting. And it's now a weekly meeting. I think it was about 2 years before anybody in Casa Grande ever came. It was just these strangers driving an hour and a half each way to get there. But one night, an old cowboy walked into that meeting, and he's shaking. He doesn't look drunk. But they're reading the 5th chapter, and he interrupts. And the chairperson said, sir, would you just be quiet until we finish reading this, and then we'll talk to you, and we'll let you talk. So he was quiet, and he listened. And the chairman said, what do you want to say? We're all ready to listen and help if we can. He said, well, I know I'm an alcoholic, and I know I need to quit drinking, but I know Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for me. And the chairman says, "What makes you think that?" He said, "Because I'm crazy. I am insane." He says, "I got papers out in the truck to prove it. Let me go get the papers." You know, and the chairman says, No, we'll take your word for it. Come on back. He said, "I'm a schizophrenic," and what he described was multiple personalities, really. He said, "You know, one of me be driving along and really good, and another person just takes over my body and drives into that liquor store." And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for me. Nobody touched that sucker for 40 minutes either. And I have learned through experience, because I always have a quick answer. I know how to help people. Please don't let me help you. I've learned from experience to just shut my mouth and bite my tongue. And if I can shut up long enough, somebody's going to come up with a better deal than I can think of. And this time it was a little old lady. And she said, "Sonny, I can help you." She said, "I really believe you're an alcoholic and I really believe you're crazy, but you don't ever have to drink again." And he looked at her, I still remember the look, so believing. And here's what she said. She said, "Son, if any one of you take a drink, you all come down drunk." And he looked at her like, "Well, I'll be damned." And he came back to our meeting sober for a number of weeks and a number of months. Lost track of him too, but where else but Alcoholics Anonymous can you get that kind of wisdom? I mean, that's amazing. That is amazing. So back to Les. "Les, I got this big problem. Tell me what it is." See, when I was working for the Air Force, I knew I was spiritually sick. And I didn't know about you guys. But I knew there were other churches. And I wanted to be close to God. And the Catholic thing wasn't doing it. I know now alcoholism gets in the way. So I would argue to have the early mass on Sunday on base, and I get dressed up in a suit and tie, and I'm going to different Protestant churches looking for a better church. I think I went to 5 of them. Have you heard that cliche about alcoholics being egomaniacs with an inferiority complex? That fits me. I'll give you a couple of examples of it. I have a learning disability. You know, I got through college, and I guess my IQ is above average, but I can't spell. I've never been able to spell. My mother was a school teacher, and I loved her. Anything I could do in my life to please my mom, I'd learn how to spell. I can't tell you how many hours I learned trying to learn how to spell. It has not happened. That was one of the big burdens of my life. I'm dumb. I'm stupid. I'm slow. I can't spell. And that had a lot of power over my life. I took elective courses in college, not based on the quality of the course or my interest, but on the kind of test they get. And if somebody gave a multiple choice test or true and false, you know, I can handle A, B, C, D, and T, and F. But if somebody with a course that I really want to go to wants to write an essay or something, I'm not going to take that course. Because I'm going to make 4 or 5 spelling mistakes in that paragraph. And they're going to know I'm stupid. Well, you know, that fear has been removed. When I lecture or give talks, that's part of what I do today. I write on a blackboard and misspell words. It doesn't bother me. Because there are always people in the audience who are good spellers. And it makes their day when they can help out. I mean, they just get off on that. Right? And besides that, I have a computer with a spell check in it. And now I can write a letter to you without hauling it to somebody and having them check it first. So you get the inferiority part about this. The grandiosity is I think God invented computers for me. You guys get the benefit of the fringe benefits of God answering my prayer about spelling. We are sick puppies. So when I'm going to these different churches, I'm just about as low as I've ever been, and yet the ego is still alive. Now, that used to be step one, ego deflation of depth. We have to be broken. We have to be busted before we will allow God to fix us. I'm going to these different churches, and I never found one where I was more comfortable. That didn't have anything to do with the churches. It had to do with the active alcoholism that I took to all those churches. That's where the bad people came from. And then one day, because I'm dealing with the wounded, someone says, "You think they're atheists in foxholes?" And we talked about that for a while, and when that person left, I'm thinking, hot damn, there's my answer. It's not another church I need. I need to be an atheist. And this had great appeal. It'll probably appeal to somebody here. See, if I don't have to believe in God, then I can do, does this sound appealing? What I want to do and not feel guilty? Hot damn, I got a whole new program here. See? When I was going to those churches, there was ego and arrogance involved. It was kind of like I was holding auditions. You know, interviewing them to see who was good enough to have me. Sick. You know, if they knew who I really was, they wouldn't want me. Anyway, so I decided to be an atheist. I worked real hard at being an atheist. I used to see, I don't have trouble with step two. I used to pray that I would be a good atheist. I prayed real hard that I'd be a good atheist. And if that makes sense to you, I'd like to see you later. Now, my sponsor knows I love circuses. He knows about the atheist attempt. And when I asked him what's wrong with me, he said, "Gavin, I know what's wrong with you. Here's what's wrong with you. The problem with you is you believe too much. Here's the man I've trusted more than anyone in my life, who knows more about me. I'm about a year sober, and I think he's poking fun at what I care the most about. And he'd always made sense before. And I felt betrayed, and I felt used, and I felt crazy, and I felt lost." And he looked at me with so much love, and he said, "I know you don't understand. Let me tell you a story. Maybe you'll get it. Suppose you and I go to a circus." He knows how to get my attention, huh? "And we're sitting there in the front row, center ring. And I'd never heard this story before. And some performer comes out and climbs a ladder and gets way up there in the ring. And he starts walking across this thin steel wire, way up there, from one side of the arena to the other. And he's pushing a little wheelbarrow from one side of that arena to the other on that wire. And you poked me in the ribs and said, 'He's not going to fall. I know this guy. He does it 2-3 times a day. He's done it for 30 years. He won't fall.' Les said, 'That's belief. But don't tell me you trust him or have any faith in his ability until you get up there with him and sit quietly in the wheelbarrow while he pushes you across.' And that's the difference between belief and faith. You can do belief with your brain. You do belief with your mouth. You can do your belief sitting down. You do faith up there with your fanny in the wheelbarrow. That's my favorite story. The wheelbarrow story." And I know what some of you are thinking. You're saying, "Geez, I don't have much belief. I don't have much faith." Well, that's just fine. That's how we get here. Well, if you keep coming around and you keep praying for the guidance, the faith grows. Faith is acting on what you believe. And if you don't have much belief, act on what the people you trust believe. Love that story. I've told it too much because every now and then I get real screwed up. And I'll go to my sponsor or friend or something. I'll say, "God, I've never been this bad before. I don't know what to do." You know, they all say the same thing. "Get back in the wheelbarrow." "Oh, darn, I forgot." I forget that a lot. There's another story I'd like to share with you about God being sneaky. You know, we have a label for a certain behavior now called being politically correct or politically incorrect. This borders a little bit on that. And because of what I'm going to say, some people might turn me off. But I'm not saying it to show off. I'm saying it to tell you the truth. Because this is how it happened. one day when I was in Phoenix, I got a call from a man. He was in the legal profession, some kind of a junior league judge type of, I think they call them referees. I don't know if you have them in Oklahoma, but anyway. And the conversation went something like this. He said, "Now, I know you know a lot about alcoholism." He said, "I want you to know clearly that I am not an alcoholic." That's the first clue. He said, "But I am beginning to suspect that perhaps someday it would be possible for me to develop a little problem with alcohol. Could I talk to you about that?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk about that. In fact, I'm going to have lunch with some friends that know a lot about that, too. Why don't you come to lunch with us?" He said, "Oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have to say I'm an alcoholic." But I said, no. He said, "Okay, I'll be there." I can't believe he said he'd be there, huh? He said, "Oh, that isn't one of those A&A meetings, is it?" I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, it is. It's a noon lunch bunch kind of thing." He says, "Well, I'm not an alcoholic." I said, "Oh, well, I know that." I think there's a word to describe that behavior. It's called a lie, because I was pretty sure he was one. Anyway, he says, "Well," I reassured him. I said, as long as you come, I'll tell the other guy you're not an alcoholic. So you're my guest, and you learn something. So I hang up on him. I get on the phone. I call four lawyer friends in the program, tell them we got a hot new prospect from their profession, and would they come to the noon meeting at the Arid Club? And they all said yes. And I showed up with my new man. Oh, he was prissy. Three-piece suit, taught Sunday school. Every hair in his head was in place. Not one of those lawyers showed up. I am preoccupied with a big resentment. But Red showed up. Red is deceased now, but Red was a biker. And Red looked the part. And Red could not complete his sentence without vulgarity. He didn't know any other verbs. So not only do the lawyers not show up, Red's there. Red's my friend. But I got a Sunday school teacher with me. So I know what to do. I start praying. And I'm sitting there praying like, you know what I'm praying for, huh? I'm praying Red not get called on. That's what I'm praying for. And I'm praying away there, and you know what happened. Red got called on. And the topic of that meeting was, utilize the program, don't analyze it. Get into action. Trust the little belief you have. So they started talking about intellectuals, and they call on Red. And Red says, "These goddamn intellectuals. Huh. I just brought one to his first meeting, Red. Shut up." Said Ben Franklin was an intellectual. Show you how wacko he was, even though he was smart. Ben Franklin believed that a good bowel movement was better than sex. This time I'm starting to slide under the table. I can't believe. Now, I have since found out that Benjamin Franklin did say that. But Red wasn't done. Red says, "You know, either I don't know how to shit or Ben doesn't know how to fuck." They called on me, and I passed. I couldn't think of anything to say. I get back in the car. I'm looking straight ahead. This guy's in the seat next to me. He's looking straight ahead. And he says with this very mechanical voice, "Thank you very much for taking me to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." I said, you're welcome. And here's the best part. He turned toward me and he softened up and he said, could you take me to another meeting? Maybe one where red goes. Oh, red touched this guy's heart. I'm sure it wasn't the Ben Franklin part, but somehow something red said connected with this guy's soul. And he started going to meetings, and he started calling himself an alcoholic, and he stayed sober. See what I mean about God being sneaky? Isn't that wonderful? He's just not going to let us figure out how he works ahead of time. If I had to describe addiction in one word, I know what it is. More. That's the whole course right there. That's all you need to know about addiction. I got a short pharmacology course, too. You know, there are all kinds of drugs. There are really three kinds. Some go up, some go down, the rest of them go around and around. It's true. Tell you about the bigotry. You know, today it's the... God's removed a lot of it, but it's picky little stuff. People who don't run meetings right. It's driving me crazy. What do you mean you're going to have a raffle? That's when we do the fifth chapter. What? And you're going to leave it out? One time I went to a meeting, they had a vote before I got there, and they played bingo instead of having the meeting. I want to pay tribute to my sponsor, Les. He loved me when I was the most unlovable. I can't pay that back. I can try to imitate him, but you can't pay those things back because they're unmerited gift. And I have a quotation from Bill Wilson. I have a few copies of it up here for you and a few copies of that prayer about getting out of bed in the morning. I don't want to start a stampede afterwards, but there are a few of these around up here. A was only 10 years old. Bill gave a talk in Los Angeles, 1947. He already had the idea he wanted to step down. He didn't want to be the guru. Well, part of it did, but another part wanted to have some kind of service structure put in place so this thing would go on so that after he died and Bob died and you and I came along, it would still be here, huh? Perhaps this is not the time or place to talk at length of my own recovery or of our AA program in detail or of our astonishing growth. This room is filled with fellow alcoholics who know and practice AA as well as I. The accomplishments, AA is only 10 years old, the accomplishments of Alcoholics Anonymous are headlined in the press of the world. So I shall be content if I can remind myself and any who would hear that Alcoholics Anonymous is not, after all, a personal success story. That's not how I got here. It is instead, listen to this, the story of our colossal human failures, now converted into the happiest kind of usefulness by the grace of God. Oh, that's so wonderful and it's so true. You're not only in a room full of ugly people, you're in a room full of colossal human failure. See, the Baptists are right. We all are sinners. But because of the grace of God, our colossal human failures have now been converted into the happiest kind of usefulness. I edited that just a little bit because there's one word that shows up here that we don't use very often. And the word is alchemy. In the Middle Ages, there were these guys called alchemists, and they were part philosopher, part magician, part chemist. And they were always trying to take something of lesser value and turn it into something of greater value. They were always trying to take lead and turn it into gold. So that last sentence really reads this way. Alcoholics Anonymous is not, after all, a personal success story. It is instead the story of our colossal human failures, now converted into the happiest kind of usefulness by that divine alchemy, the living grace of God. Powerful words, but not nearly as powerful as the experience that I've had here this weekend with you people. Because something happens when we get together. And what that is a lot better than what alcohol ever did. Let me get back to the bigotry. The bigotry takes the form of disapproval of people not doing what I want them to do today. I conduct retreats for recovering people a couple of times a year in Colorado Springs. And every time the retreat's over, I go to a Sunday afternoon meeting. And they have a custom there going around the room, introducing themselves by name and saying that they're an alcoholic. So they go around the room. I'm Barbara, an alcoholic. I'm Jesse, an alcoholic. I'm Rick, an alcoholic. I'm Charlotte, an alcoholic. First time I went to that meeting, I thought that was kind of neat. But then we get to this one guy, and he says, "My name's Sylvester, and I'm an alcoholic growing along spiritual lines." And I thought, well, isn't that cute? I have another friend who has one of those little trademark things. Every time Sylvester gets called, him, "My name's Sylvester. I'm an alcoholic, grown along spiritual life." I have a friend in San Jose. Let's say his name's George. And people feed him this straight line because they know what he's going to say. He's a wonderful man, but he's kind of a burned-out hippie. The synapses don't connect all the time. He's talking about this, and we're over here, and then we're here. I just remembered his real name. His real name is Leon. You know, you go up to him and say, "Hi, Leon, how you doing?" He said, "Right on schedule." Geez, that proves he's not hooked up, huh? I want to pay tribute to a friend of mine. Charlie talked about absolutely indescribable, wonderful feelings. I want to talk about that a little bit, but pay tribute to a very dear friend of mine named John Foster from Denver, who's now deceased. John and I became great friends. This is how God works. I grew up in a very homophobic family. That means you don't like people who are attracted to the same sex. And after John and three or four other people that I got real close to in the Denver area and got to know each other real well, one night John just happened to mention being gay. And I didn't know that. And I'm not gay. You guys don't do a thing for me. And by that time, I cared so much about John, you know, it didn't matter. And I could see some clues to that after he talked about it. Then a few years later, a flyer went around the Arizona area advertising an AA conference called Spring Break, Spring Break 1. And I look at the speakers, and there's John F. from Denver, Colorado. And I call John up, and I say, "Are you speaking in Phoenix on such and such a date?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What's the spring break thing?" He said, "It's the first gay AA conference in Arizona." I said, "Oh, that's too bad. I wanted to go hear you." He said, "Well, you could be my guest." Well, geez, thanks, John. I had a little discretionary money for charity in those days, and I came up with scholarships for three or four people to attend that conference. And because the people knew that I knew their Sunday morning speaker, and because I'd helped some of these other people out, they kind of made a project out of me. And they kept saying, "Come and listen to John." So I finally worked up enough courage, and I said, "Well, if I sit in the back and I don't tell anybody who I see there and maybe sit behind a screen, could I come to John's talk?" They said, "Sure." They talked me into going to the whole weekend. I can't believe I'm going to a gay AA conference. I wasn't there 20 minutes, and I knew that everybody there There were only a couple of hundred people. Everybody there knew that I was straight and that it was okay for me to be there. And there was so much love there that weekend. So much love. And I felt comfortable there. Isn't that amazing? So next year they needed to raise money for spring break too. And they said, we're going to have a banquet. Would you be our speaker? And then we'll have a dance later. I said, sure. So there's flyers all over Arizona. Spring Break 2 fundraiser, Gavin G. Banquet Speaker. So there's still some people in that area that think I'm gay. And you know what? It doesn't matter what they think. It doesn't matter what they think. See what God has done to my bigotry? Just kicked it in the butt. And he continues to do that. Time after time. Seems like there's one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, you talked about jail and prison. I've been in jail and prison a lot, but as a chaplain, they let me go home. So I've never been locked up that way. But I remember the first state conference I ever went to was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and there was a wonderful woman, golly, maybe I'll think of her name, Ramona. And Ramona had a little poem, a little saying, and I added to it. Ramona's dead now, and I don't remember what goes to Ramona and what's my part, but it's unfinished, and I like to have it unfinished. And it talks a little bit about the experience that Sonny spoke of. Well, let me tell you this. Here's how God works. There were 9 in my ordination class, and we were a bright class. And before we were ordained priests, they asked us if we wanted to go on to higher studies. And I was the only one in the 9 that said, no, not yet. Let me have some life experience first. Had no idea the life experience I was going to get. So the other 8 go off to get their doctorates and all that kind of stuff. And guess who makes the education section of Time magazine? And has his picture there. I don't talk about that very often. But it ties in with the drinking. It just seems to fit today. I was still drinking. I got my picture in Time magazine. You know what it said? It was a week-long poverty workshop that I ran for about 100 people. You know, we put them in police cars for a shift. We had them panhandle. We had them picking cotton. We had a 24-hour marathon sensitivity session. Found out that we were all emotionally poor. By the time that week was over, all the do-gooders that showed up for it, myself included, found out that the people that we thought were poor gave more to us than we gave to them. And we're all poor. Just like we're all sinners. Boy, we don't use that word around here, do we? Let me translate it into a language. We're all colossal human failures. You know what the caption says? There's a picture of me up against a brick wall talking to another individual who doesn't look like he's in very good shape. And it says, Father Gavin on Phoenix Skid Row. It's exactly where I was. And they're all thinking, he's the guy. They didn't know that I had the Skid Row of my own. So you might want to finish this little thing yourself, and I'll pause for a minute and say a couple other things and I'll be done. I think any alcoholic could own these words. I used to live in a little locked box. And the little locked box was me. Alcohol lined it with mirrors so that no matter where I looked, I was all that I could see. And then I met people like you. And the mirrors turned into windows. And if you keep coming back and go to enough meetings, you get out of that box and you'll be able to finish the poem. We all lived on Skid Row. We all lived in little locked boxes. But we're loose today. Man, sometimes people ask me how I'm doing. I say, I'm walking around loose. Nobody's looking for me. I mean, this is hot stuff. Let's see. What do I want to get back to here? Anybody remember what I started and didn't finish? Oh, my friend John Foster. He wrote something. Usually we don't read things to people here, but this gets right inside of an alcoholic. And I just love what goes on here, because it's your story. And I thank God I knew John and that he helped me with some of my bigotry and that he wrote this. And I love sharing it with you. It's entitled, I Am Not a Duck. I may look like a duck and walk like a duck and quack like a duck and even drink like a duck, but I am not a duck. I'm an eagle in disguise. If you could prove to me that it's respectable to be a duck, I might consider being one. But don't waste your time. My mind's made up. I think it's shameful to be a duck. I wouldn't be a duck. It's so lonely here among all these ducks. I'm so out of place. But you know, for some reason, the eagles will have nothing to do with me either. Why are eagles cruel? Some of the ducks are rather nice. Too bad I'm an eagle. No, it isn't. I'm glad I'm an eagle. Even if I were a duck, I wouldn't stay a duck. I'd become an eagle. Ducks are terrible. I hate ducks. I keep trying to swoop down and grab a rabbit in my claws, but I can't do it. I have these webbed feet. It's all God's fault. Why would God make an eagle with webbed feet? If I starve to death, God will only have himself to blame. I do my part. Why doesn't he do his? The ducks all want to help. But how can they? What does a duck know about eagle problems? Why can't they mind their own business? Why don't the eagles offer to help? Someday I'll get even with those eagles. I hate them. I'm beginning to like ducks better than eagles. Being an eagle is killing me. Not being a duck is killing me. I don't know what's killing me. I just know I'm dying. Help me. Help me, God. God, help me. Guess what? I'm a duck. Whether I like it or not, I'm a duck. Why didn't you tell me? I've forgotten how to act. Show me, God, how to be a duck. Help me. Help me be a good duck. Ducks are the best people in the whole world. I love ducks. I'm grateful to be a duck. Fellowship of the Spirit. That's what we've been doing. And that's what's important. I'll leave today, and you might remember me, and that's not important, because other people will come into your life that love this program and can do for you what I can't do. But I'm glad to be part of your life this weekend. I appreciate being here more than you know. Thank you for putting up with my less than healthy voice. But after staying up all night for a couple of nights, and I know some of you did, you did real good paying attention. And that's probably because you care about sobriety like I do. Al-Anons can be cheated sometimes. I thank God for the Al-Anon. I'm a member of Al-Anon. How'd I get to Al-Anon? I don't have a wife. Well, it's real easy. My boss rounded up a bunch of alcoholic priests to live with me so I could sober them up. That's how I got to Al-Anon. And if I can tell you, if you don't qualify for Al-Anon, don't fake it, Just belong to the programs you qualify for. I qualify for so many, I can't get around to all of them. But, we need to have a primary program, and mine's Alcoholics Anonymous. If I ever get away from that, drunk Al-Anons are dangerous, huh? Whether you realize it or not, what I've talked mostly about here is God. But it's not God that I was taught about in school or in church or learned about from a book. I've tried to share the God of my experience because that's what we do. We share our experience, strength, and hope. Experience, strength, and hope are such powerful words. Usually that's all we hear when we hear that sentence.
But the operative word, the verb, is share. That's what we do when we get together. We share. Most people in our culture die without ever sharing their story with anyone. You and I aren't like that. And because you aren't like that, and because I'm not like that, we're richer because of it. I have two thoughts to end with. For many years, I was at the Franciscan Renewal Center in Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, and that's a real swanky neighborhood. People come from all over the world there. Sometimes they stay for a week or two, and because the neighborhood's full of all these mansions, every now and then someone will kind of side up to you and say, wow, I can't believe how big these houses are. Do you know any people live there? I say, yeah. Well, if you visit any of them this week, could I ride along and get a closer look? You know, something like that. So I used to give tours every now and then of the neighbors' houses. And one day, this young couple really wanted to know a little more about that, and there was another couple that owned this big mansion, and I thought they'd get along together, so I introduced them, and they hit it off just fine. And when I'm taking them back to the retreat house, the husband said something that was kind of funny. He said, thank you for showing me around the wealthy person's home. So I said, oh, you're welcome. And I'm walking around the backyard, some undeveloped desert land out there, and the sun's going down. And it's reflecting off the windows in some of those mansions up on Mummy Mountain and Camelback Mountain. And it's a beautiful sight. And as often happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of a sudden I knew something. I knew it that quick, without any process at all. And what I knew, instantaneous, without any premonition, was that I'm wealthy. I lived in a lot of different neighborhoods. There's any more happiness in that neighborhood than there is in others. I know that. There's a great advantage in being poor. You know who your friends are. Boy, am I getting blank stares now. I never thought of that. Anyway, I've had a little time to think about this. So I've thought about it a little bit, and I have a way of saying what I want to say to you. I think I've been around long enough to know what fulfills people and what makes them happy. And I've got it in three words: faith and friends and freedom. And if you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon or any other 12-step program and you live that life, no matter where you go, you're going to have friends. And the faith is automatic. It's operative when we get together. And you'll know a new freedom. I looked at the paper today, but the headlines could easily read, 400 of the wealthiest people in Oklahoma met at a travel lodge. Is that the name of this place? Met at the no-name hotel in Oklahoma City this weekend. Central Plaza, thank you. Isn't that a surprise to find out you're wealthy? Well, just in case you forget who I am and what this has been about, my name's Gavin. I'm an alcoholic grown along spiritual lines, and I'm right on schedule, and so are you.